Okay, ladies and gentlemen, in the interest of time, we're going to move ahead and kind of between salad and your entree, we're going to ask for you to just introduce yourself. Just tell us a little bit about who you are. And as I said earlier, this is a Multicultural Affairs Luncheon at the 2014 ACB Conference Convention. And our theme this year is Playing the Hand You're Dealt. So if anybody wants to give us like a minute version of how you play the hand you're dealt along with your introduction, but it has to be very quick because we're running behind time. Okay, so we're going to start at this front table right here with introductions.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
This is Tim Paul from Chicago. Active in the local chapter ACBMC and also in the Illinois chapter ICB, and also in the president of the local Lions Club as well.
You need to get on the mic.
Wait, I thought
because we're recording and you're not coming through too well, Tim. So
I need to
put the mic right up close to your mouth.
My name is Tim Paul, and I'm from Chicago.
My name is Terrell Brewster, and I'm from Champaign, Illinois.
My name is Teddy Joy Rimhild, and I'm from Burbank, California. And in California, I'm one of the original members of the association affiliate and of the California Council of the Blind of the Association for Multicultural Concerns, which is now we're celebrating our 20th anniversary in California. So I think that's something to be proud of.
Very good.
Good afternoon. My name is Jacqueline Jackson. I'm from San Diego also and a member of the Association of Multicultural Concerns. And how I deal with the hand I'm dealt, I have a choice to be pitiful or powerful, and I choose to be powerful.
Yay.
All right.
Hi, I'm Charles Navarrete, and after a 43-year legal career and 24 years as an administrative law judge, I'm retiring at the end of next month. So I am dealing with my hands.
Hi, I'm Lillian Scaife from Long Beach, California. And I am the president of the Association of Multicultural Concerns. And we will be celebrating our 20th year. And I worked for aerospace for 20 years. And, you know, just life, you just deal with it. You deal with the hand because life is always changing and you always have circumstances to deal with.
I'm Frank Pacheco.
I'm Frank Pacheco, here from Silver Spring, Maryland. And it's a
like to eat my lunch.
Pleasure to be here.
But I don't want to get too far from the recording.
Hi, I'm Terry Pacheco. I'm also from Silver Spring, Maryland. Isn't that a coincidence? I've always been a firm believer in, you know, taking what we've got and going with it. One of the things that we've done is a few of us started a group for professional visually impaired women, and actually it's called Visually Impaired Empowered Women, which is VIEW, not to be confused with Whoopi Goldberg's VIEW, but and we've started that, and it's the Greater District of Columbia area, and I'm also the owner of the Alternate Format Pros. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Sandra Sermons. I am from Rockville, Maryland.
I'm a member of this committee, which is wonderful. And in terms of, you know, playing the hand that I've been dealt, the reality is that the only constant in life is change. So what I try to do is just not let my blindness define me. I'm Sandra first and everything else second. And I just choose to participate in a career that is not traditionally blindness friendly. And take what comes, because potentially I could be here for a long while, and I don't want to just exist. I want to live and play.
Hi, I'm Zelda Gemhardt, and when I signed up for this, I just was so intrigued by the title. I had no idea who was sponsoring it, but I wanted to try it. And I think that's what we have to do in life, is try it. We got to try it and see if it fits.
Hello, my name is Waveney Cameron. I'm here as a guest of my daughter, Cheryl Cameron. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Gretchen Mowney, and I am from Columbia, Missouri, and just finished a term of being president of our local chapter, the Tiger Council of the Blind, named after the University of Missouri Tigers. Anyway, the way I play the hand I'm dealt is, I know we're all, well, pretty much all of us in here are visually impaired and stuff, but I went from being very sighted, as in not even like wearing glasses or anything, to going blind the last semester of my senior year of college. And for a while I was really depressed and like was like a hermit and stuff, but I finally got up and was like, whatever. And that's obviously in a nutshell, but and then finished up that, and then went and just finished grad school, and also am still making myself do all these things that I didn't think I could do anymore that I used to do when I could see. In fact, I started kickboxing classes back in January, and I used to love going to arcades, and I can still go and play skee-ball, and I figured out how to do that again, and all kinds of stuff. So I'm not letting not being able to see get in my way. So thank you.
Quiet Water again. Deanna Noriega, Quiet Water. I was the oldest of five kids and the only one with a disability, and I was the first one to go to college. I served in the Peace Corps because they wouldn't take me in the military. And I've pretty much done everything I ever wanted to do. I still have not piloted a plane. I did drive a car and hit a lot of traffic cones. But
hello, my name is Ivy. I'm from China, Macau. Yeah, I'm visually impaired. Yeah, I'm studying in university in my city. I want to learn more from in this ACB conference. I want to improve my city. Thank you.
That's a hard act to follow. I'm Marcia Farrow from Somerville, Georgia, and some of you all probably think being from the South is a handicap, and it certainly can be at times. But I am very, very fortunate. I consider my vision loss as a gift. I really do, and it has taught me so much about life that I wouldn't trade it for anything. I would do it again. I would. But I was fortunate to grow up, like my mom and dad were born at home, okay? So that's where I'm coming from. But yet, my uncle married a lady from Thailand. So very early in my life, I was exposed to differences. And thank God I didn't grow up so backwards as I might have. So living near Atlanta, I was exposed to a lot of things. So culture has been important to me as long as I can remember. Thank you, Ms.
Hello, I'm Jean Braddon from San Bernardino, California.
Can you talk closer to the mic, please?
Jean Brannon from San Bernardino, California. Okay. I'm a member of the Association of Multicultural Concerns and officer in my chapter of the California Council of the Blind. And dealing with the hand I was dealt is being here at the convention. I was applying to be a first-timer scholarship. And, of course, I'm not computerized, so I didn't get my paperwork in time. So, leading to that, my daughter took her vacation time and gave me this trip to come as my birthday gift, early birthday gift.
We're glad you're here.
Almost 8 years old.
My name is Lily Wilson, and I'm past president of Agape Council of the Blind from St. Louis, Missouri. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Vera Rice. I'm with Agape Council of the Blind from St. Louis, Missouri.
I'm Donna Pomerantz from California, and let's see, playing the hand you're dealt, I guess what I'll say is, I always play it straight.
Mitch Pomerantz, I'm a white Jewish boy from Pasadena, California. And I will defer commenting on the topic because I've been dragooned by our friend Ms. Garrett into talking a little later. All I'll say is that I'm in a multicultural marriage, so I have a hand to deal with every day.
Yes, good afternoon. Hi, you guys. This is Pam Metz, and I live in Southern California, San Fernando Valley area, and there's not too many of us colored people running around San Fernando Valley. I have a white Jewish boy at home with a black Labrador Retriever, and my guide dog and my dog is a yellow Labrador Retriever, so we basically have a multicultural home.
Okay, did I miss anyone other than the head table?
Me.
Who said me? Marlena, where are you?
She's over at the other table.
First. Okay.
I'm Marlena Lieberg. I have the honor of being second vice president of the American Council of the Blind and the honor of being the board liaison officer to this wonderful, wonderful committee.
Yay.
And if Kim takes me off, I'm going to have to take her out. So there you go.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. And it's always nice to know who's here. We get some folks who come back year after year and others who are first-timers. But we welcome you all. We're glad you're here. And we do have a very diverse group today, and that's absolutely wonderful. That's what we're aiming for. So enjoy your meal, and we'll have introduction of our speaker and our speaker in just a few minutes. Okay, our speaker today is a member of our Multicultural Affairs Committee. Her name is Cheryl Cummings. She is from Boston, Massachusetts, and she works for the University of Massachusetts Medical School. She is a former member of the Peace Corps, and I'm sure she'll tell you much more about herself during her presentation. So let's give her a round of applause and thank her for stepping in today and being our presenter.
Okay, can folks hear me?
Yes.
All right, so this is either a good thing or a bad thing. I'm interrupting your lunch, and I hope what I have to say, you know, doesn't affect your digestion. So let me start off by saying good afternoon to everyone and welcome. Before I go any further, I would really like to thank Peggy and Donna and the members of the committee for inviting me to speak with you this afternoon. When Peggy called and asked me what was going to be the title of my speech, this phrase sort of popped into my head. And the phrase that popped into my head was soaring beyond expectations. Even before I began to gather information for the speech, I started to think about all of the quote-unquote expectations that as blind people and people of color, we have to overcome in order to live our lives. So because I work as a policy researcher and didn't really think it would be enough to just talk from my own experiences, I started to do some reading. One of the things I did was I began by looking up the word expectation. And according to dictionary.com, a go-to source, expectation means the act or state of looking forward or anticipating the prospect of future good or profit.
Sorry about that, guys.
Oh, that's okay. So then, even with this kind of hopeful and positive connotation, did this mean I really had to rethink the title of my speech? And the truth is, of course not, because although expectations are understood as hoped for future good, my experience has shown that in our case, expectations can be low and negative, or even worse, because people aren't sure what the future will hold for us, expectations are not even discussed. So even though opportunities exist today that allow us to succeed at school, at work, and in our personal lives, there's still a struggle that we have to deal with. So remember I told you I work as a policy person. So here is some data which I'd like to share with you because I think it exemplifies a reality that we all face. So according to the 2012 American Community Survey, 37.7% of individuals with visual disabilities were employed. 24% of individuals with visual disabilities were employed full-time, full year round. And 31% of us live below the poverty line. A few more bits of data I wanted to share with you. And now switching databases and talking about all people with disabilities. In 2013, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 17.6% of people with all disabilities were employed, whereas 64% of people without disabilities are employed. The other bit of information is, again, in 2013, the rate of unemployment for people with disabilities, that's all people with disabilities, was 13.4%, and for people without disabilities, it's 7.1%. And here's the last bit of information, which I thought was really meaningful and I wanted to share with you. So the summary from the Bureau of Labor Statistics goes on to say that the unemployment rate for people with disabilities remained little changed from 2012 to 2013, whereas people without disabilities, the unemployment rate declined. So how do we not give in to these realities which can then impact our expectations? How do we soar beyond expectations? I think the fact that somebody said this, I think the fact that we are here is one indication that we are soaring, that we are not allowing low and negative expectations to determine who we are and what we do. So much of what we read, hear, and are told is that in order to succeed, it is up to you. But we also know that there are external obstacles that can prevent you from moving forward and prevent you from succeeding. I think one road to success is to continue despite these obstacles. I was born in Guyana, South America, and was sighted. As a child, my grandmother signed me up for, I think, every possible after-school activity. One of those activities was dance. Around 5 or 6 years old, I started taking dance, and we were taught ballet, and we were also taught African dance. One day, a movie crew came to our school and were selecting girls to be in a movie. They were selecting only girls who were light-skinned, and I was not selected. My grandmother came to pick me up and asked what was going on. My grandmother then told them, the movie crew, that she thought her granddaughter was just as good as any of the other kids they'd selected, and that they should allow me to be in the movie. She must have done something else than just speaking, because not only was I in the movie, but my next-door neighbor, who was also in the dance school, was in the movie. I tell you that story because it is something that I have held on to and used throughout my life to start to shape my path. There are lots of external messages that tell us that we don't make the grade, that we aren't the correct type. And the way we succeed is that we don't allow these external messages to determine what we do and who we do. So coming to the United States was quite a shock. In as much as we gained a lot of wonderful things, there were still challenging things. As a young child, I don't think I was always aware of all of the obstacles. Somehow, through my grandmother and my mother's actions, I got the message that I was... I got the message that I should not allow people's expectations or to determine what I do, and that I should proceed even though there might be some oppositions to what I wanted to do. In Chicago, our family went to a lot of places where often our family was one of very few black families, and I suppose that probably upset a few people, but it never stopped us. We went anyway. I think this is a quandary that families of color and families with children with disabilities face. That is, when do you start to let your children in on some of the obstacles and challenges they will face? A few years ago, I started a nonprofit organization called Our Space, Our Place. We do offer a year-round after-school and career exploration program for blind youth. Each year, as we plan the career exploration workshop, one of the issues we discuss is how much of the data around sort of life outcomes and employment do we include in our brochures, or do we share with the students who are participating. So far, we have selected not to talk too much about data. Instead, we try to provide an opportunity that the middle and high school students who are blind who are participating see as a learning opportunity, and we stay away from the data. Part of why we do that is that we don't want the children to be overwhelmed by the data, and neither do we want them to become so paralyzed by the reality that they give up before even trying. I'm grateful that my family created opportunities that told me I was smart and that I could achieve what I wanted to do. However, as I moved out into the world and my own understanding of history and circumstances grew, the obstacles and negativity became more obvious. I was fortunate to attend Princeton University. There, I delved into African-American history, Caribbean history, and was involved in lots and lots of student groups. It was also there that I began to meet people who would insist that because I came from another country, I couldn't really be an African-American. Of course, that is true on some level, but on another level, it is wholly meaningless. As a person of African descent, prejudice, discrimination, and racism does not differentiate. People see a person, a black person, and I can't ever recall a situation when someone asked if I was African, African-American, or Caribbean, and then changed their behavior depending on my response. I believe that we need groups like the Multicultural Committee to realize our commonalities and to use those to succeed together. What good does it do us as individuals or even as members of a group to focus only on our differences? It is imperative that we find common ground so that together we can work to create opportunities which allow us all to succeed. So, okay, here I've got to make a little confession. In my younger days, I used to look around me and see that there were other people who were soaring beyond expectations and who were doing really well. And I wonder what was wrong with me. Why wasn't I succeeding also? And when I was in those types of situations, the negativity, the focus on all the things I couldn't do, the sort of repetition of what's wrong and started to really take over my life. And that inner voice that used to tell me I was okay was now repeating all of the negative things. I was miserable, I was depressed, sad, and just unpleasant to be around. It took some time, but I regained my equilibrium. I wasn't always here, but at 47, here's one thing I've come to realize. That is that my ability to soar beyond expectations is linked with your ability to soar beyond expectations. And so, therefore, if I find something out and I am succeeding, I need to be willing to make space and to help you to also succeed. And hopefully if you find something out and you're succeeding, you will also be willing to make space and to reach out and to help me succeed. I think those people who tell you that they did it all by themselves aren't being truthful, or else they don't recognize the helping hands they received along the way. The other thing I've come to realize is that to make change, I don't need to be someone that anyone thinks is important. I can contribute to making my community, my state, my country inclusive just by getting involved. So soaring beyond expectations doesn't mean I have to climb a mountain. It doesn't mean I have to have the most money in the world. It certainly doesn't mean I have to live in the biggest house or run a large corporation. It just means I have to live my life to its fullest. Of course, for some, it may mean climbing a mountain or running a large corporation. It could also mean perhaps graduating from high school or joining your church choir or maybe just planting a garden. I know the statistics. I know the reality of what it means to be blind, a woman, and an African American. I know that because of all of these things, my future prospects aren't supposed to be so good, but really, truly, what does that matter to me? I recently heard someone say that we write our own life chapters, and because I truly believe that we do, I plan to soar beyond expectations. So in conclusion, I'd like to share a poem by Maya Angelou. And what I'd like to say is I'm not a dramatic reader. So I hope you'll all be a little forgiving as I read this to you. But I just thought it says a lot. Let's see. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? 'Cause I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my own living room. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still, I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops weakened by my soulful cries? Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard, 'cause I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I am a black ocean leaping and swelling, I'm a black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that is wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and hopes of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise. So thank you all for listening to me. Peggy, do I take questions? Oh. So if anybody has any questions, if you'd like to maybe say your name and just shout it out, that would be great. No questions, no comments, no statements?
Marsha Farah back here.
Okay.
What is the one...
Can we get a mic turned on for the recording?
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Peggy?
Yes.
Okay.
I just wanted to. It was wonderful. It was very, very. Close.
Am I playing
your mic?
Oh,
I'm sorry. Really close. Is it there?
No. I wonder if it's still on.
I don't know. Is it on? Okay.
Maybe Sharon can repeat the question.
Okay.
Okay. I'll keep it as brief as possible. I just wanted to ask if you had a wish, just, you know, wish for anything, mm-hmm. what would be from everything you said and who you are, what would be your wish for change that you could see that you feel like would be helpful to us all?
Wow. Okay. So Marsha's asking a really tough question, which is, if I had a wish, what would be my wish for change that could help us all? I suppose if I had a wish, one of the things I would wish for is that the processes and systems that exist that they allowed us to succeed as well as anybody else. Yes. And what I mean by that is, you know, it would be nice. I mean, people, employment is, as you can tell, is one of my main issues. So people talk about folks with disabilities, how loyal we are. And in as much as that's a selling point, it drives me nuts because I'm like, we don't, just don't have the flexibility that everybody else has. So we can, of course, turn it into a positive thing and say it's loyalty, but it's a lack of flexibility on some level also. So I wish that the systems and processes that exist, you know, the way they assist folks without disabilities to achieve their goals, I wish they work just as well to help us to achieve our goals. Because I think in as much as things are better, there are laws that protect us, there are people, allies who are committed to helping us succeed, and we're committed to helping us succeed, there's still a lot of obstacles. And it would be nice not to have to deal with so many obstacles all the time. Other questions? That's it?
I have a question.
Sure.
You said that you were born with sight.
Yes.
And I wonder, when did you lose your sight? And how do you think that the... that your loss of sight shaped you perhaps differently than you may have been if you hadn't lost your sight?
Ooh. People, you know, I know these are not easy questions. Maybe I should wrap it up now. So Marlena asked, how did I lose my sight? Mm-hmm. And sort of how do I think that has impacted who I am now? So I was in freshman year in high school when I contracted encephalitis and became blind. And I always say this because I think it's important to put it into perspective, because I'm sure my mom, who's sitting in the back of the room, could tell you there was a point where the doctors told her that there wasn't anything else they could do, and that she should just, you know, let me go. And then when I did come out of a coma, there was still a lot of concern, like, would she talk? And then once I started, they're like, thank God, she should shut up now. and you know, would she walk? And so I think sort of having come through that illness and only coming out with lack of vision, for me, is, it's like, okay, that's a good deal. that was, you know, I think because I'm still sort of growing, and even though it's been 30-something years, I think there are days when I'm still adjusting to not being able to see. It has shaped me in the sense that I'm probably better at listening to people, more interested in sort of getting to know others. I mean, my husband would tell you that, you know, between the two of us, he's the more social one. He will get on a bus and chat with anybody. I will not do that. But one of the things that having vision or having no vision has caused me to do is that I sometimes do need to do that. You know, you need to reach out to people, I think, who you might not normally have reached out to. And sometimes it's turned out to be a really sort of cool experience. So I think that's one of the ways. I try not to be somebody who does things to prove to other people that I can do them. So I try to focus on things that I'm really interested in doing and to try to resist people pulling me into saying, oh, you know, you're blind and you're the super person and blah, blah, blah. And similarly, folks who, you know, they meet me and they say, oh, I don't know why people think this is a compliment. Oh, for a black person, you speak really well. You know, or actually they don't say that. They say, you are so articulate. Yeah. And you think, excuse me? What should I be doing? So sometimes it's putting, you know, being nice to people and trying to say, because this is who I am, I'm a black person, I'm a blind person, so this is how people are who are like me. So I don't know if that answered your question. Okay. All right, anything else? All right, I'm going to take the silence to step away now. Thank you all very much.
Thank you so much, Cheryl, for sharing that with us this afternoon. Now I feel like I know you a little bit better. And I know, like you said, that while we may come from different backgrounds, we've all experienced some of the same things. And we grow from those things. And basically, like our theme, we play the hand we're dealt to the best of our abilities. So let's give Cheryl another hand. Thank you so much, Cheryl. We really appreciate you sharing that with us. Is anyone sighted in the room?
Yes.
Anybody sighted? Okay, I need some help. We're going to draw some names for a few door prizes just to show our appreciation for you all coming and sharing with us this afternoon. So if I could have someone come up and draw a couple of names for me, I'd appreciate it.
I was told whenever this started to turn in my card because it was left at my place because I was.
Oh, well, let's get your card in here then.
Okay.
Did you write your name? Is your name written on it?
Yes.
Okay, very good.
I wrote it on there. Donna.
Okay, good. We wouldn't want you to miss out on the chance to win a door prize. Okay, let me shake them out. Shake, 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 shake. Okay. If you're reaching in and grab one. Frank.
Pacheco.
Frank Pacheco. Pacheco. Frank. All right.
Oh, he stepped out of
it. Which CD is it? Is Terry still here?
Tropical Oasis.
Okay. Well, he won a very nice CD, a Tropical Oasis, so that he and Terry can just sit back and relax and listen to some soft music. So I'll make sure they receive that. And the next one is...
Donna Pomeranz.
Donna Pomeranz. And she's out helping someone. Oh, she just stepped back in the door. Okay, Donna, you just won the CD. Nice. Another soft evening with Mitch. No, not this one. Okay, and then the last one goes to...
No name.
Okay, try another one. It's probably mine because I didn't put a name on mine.
Name?
That's Michael's. There were two of us that didn't put names on it.
Terry.
Terry Pacheco. Terry. And they both stepped out of the room. Okay. Well, they both won. They don't have a choice of which one they want to listen to. All right. Well, we're going to move into our afternoon program. We're just going to take maybe a 2 or 3 minute break and let people finish their desserts or whatever, and then we're going to start with our afternoon program. Our afternoon program is consisting of 3 panelists. They are Pam Metz, Mitch Pomeranz, and Deanna Noriega. And they're going to share with us some life experiences and how they've learned to deal with the hand that they were dealt. And also, coming from 3 different cultural backgrounds, some of the issues that they faced in those particular cultures. So we're going to take just a couple of minutes, and then we're going to get started with our panel. Okay, our panelists this afternoon are, to my right, Deanna Noriega, To her right is Mitch Pomerantz, and to the far end is Pam Metz. And they're going to discuss this afternoon some of the cultural differences that they've encountered growing up or living as a person who's blind or visually impaired. And somewhere in there, they're going to connect that to how they dealt with the hand, how they played the hand that they were dealt. So I'll turn it over to our panelists.
Okay, Deanna, I think you're gonna have to come up here. Yeah.
Okay.
Because I'm fortunate with the cordless
working.
Cordless good working.
Okay. Okay. As soon as I figure out where the microphone is. Whoops, there it is. Peggy's a lot taller than I am, so this there we go. I mentioned before that I was the oldest of five children. There is a particular role in Native American families. The firstborn daughter. You've probably heard the name Winona. That's where it comes from. It's Winona is firstborn daughter in Ojibwe. Ojibwe is the language group that my mother's people are part of. She's Chippewa. When she was 14, she met my father. They were married when she was 16, and I was born when she was 17. Young marriages is a pretty common thing in my culture. Also, with the firstborn daughter, you are mama's second pair of hands. So from the time I was tall enough to reach the sink standing on a chair, I was washing dishes. As soon as I was strong enough, I was lifting baby brothers, changing diapers. My mother taught me to sew by hand, to knit, to cook, and do all of the things that firstborn daughter does, because with five of us, she needed that second pair of hands. And I wasn't cut any slack for not being able to see. I lost my vision when I was 8, and I got to be really good with a slingshot by sound, because I couldn't chase my younger brothers and sister, but I could nail them on the run. I was very good at throwing my shoes, anything else I happened to have in my hand, if they wouldn't listen to me and obey, because my responsibility when my mother would sometimes have to work three jobs to keep a roof over our head, having quit school at 14, she didn't have the kind of educational background that would allow her for a very high-paying job. So she'd wait tables, sell shoes. Every summer we picked fruit for our school clothes money. And yes, you can be an agricultural worker as a blind child. I picked cucumbers, cherries. I picked the cucumbers I didn't like much, green beans. The only negative effect that I can remember having is running into a huge gunny sack of green beans at the end of the row, and I thought it was a fat lady bent over and said, "Pardon me, ma'am." So, also, as part of my heritage, we have our government name that goes on our birth certificate, but we also have our true name. My great-grandmother gave me my true name, and I anglicize it by saying Quiet Water. It's actually Shaneka Mukwe, and it doesn't exactly mean quiet water, because when you're moving from one language to another, there is never really a close approximation. Sometimes there are concepts or things that take a lot of words to say that in that culture are only one. So Shanigame Kwe, the Kwe part means female, and Shanigame is a kind of day. Gama is water, but it's a day when the Great Lakes are so still and peaceful and calm that you can take a birch bark canoe out on it and go fishing. So that would be really long to put on my bylines when I write, and that's when I mostly use Quiet Water as my middle name, which confused my employer so much, because I am a published poet and writer, that they still have my paycheck
coming to me as Diana Q. Noriega. The biggest difference, I think, in a Native family is that everyone is valued for themselves, and everyone is accepted for who they truly are. So we don't have biases against gay and lesbian people. They are our people, too. We never had that as an issue. Even the smallest child is taught that they contribute to the well-being of the family because it's a lot more communal. So there is no crying baby in a Native American family. It's passed from willing lap to willing lap. It's watched by everyone. And I was surrounded by love as a child growing up. And when I finally did hit the mainstream culture entering school was the first time I was really ever made aware that I was different than my brothers and sisters. Because I was firstborn daughter, I was the bossy big sister, I was mama's confident and sounding board when she'd sit there with the bills and say, God, there isn't enough money to pay all of them, which one should we not pay? And, of course, I would say, oh, the light bill, Mama. I don't need it. So I grew up with a very strong sense of who I was and that I was a valuable human being. And then I go out in the mainstream and find out that they don't think I'm so valuable. They think I'm a poor little thing. And that was kind of a shock. One example of that was my mother gave us each a dollar, and there was a carnival in not too far. So my brothers and I walked to the carnival, and with our dollar we could get 10 tickets to ride the rides. And every time I would get to the head of the line and hand my ticket to the carny, he would look down at this little blind girl with her long braids and her long skirt, and he'd say, oh, honey, you don't have to pay to ride. And so I'd put the ticket back in my pocket, and when my brothers ran out of their tickets, I passed out my tickets again, and we got to ride longer. And then we went home, and my mama said, well, did you have a nice time? And my littlest brother said, yeah, but I don't get it. Why is everybody so nice to her just because she's a girl? So, in a way, my culture protected me from growing up with a negative self-image. I knew who I was, and I was Quiet Water. And Quiet Water was my gifted name from my great-grandmother. And if my great-grandmother, who is very wise, knew me as a person who was complete in themselves and perfect, well, of course I was then. You know, and the rest of the world just got it wrong. So going off to college, I left for college in 1968, and I left my protective, connected, large family. And I appeared on campus with my long braids and my moccasins and my long skirts. And they thought I was a psychedelic urchin. And they thought that, you know, I was told I was hung up because I would not accept invitations to go sleep with whomever that I happened to be just talking to. And that was fine with me because I was raised as a master sergeant's daughter and a Native American princess. And princesses have an obligation to stand tall and represent their people proudly and not do anything to bring negative attention to their people. Because every day when we left the res, we were told that our fathers were drunks and beat our mothers, and that we were not good people. And so my mother always insisted that we speak well, that we conduct ourselves graciously. I was the only little girl I knew who knew how to curtsy and said, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, and who didn't speak to adults until I was spoken to.
So the toughest part for me was overcoming the quiet reserve that is part of our people. When we're together with our friends, thinks Mitch, my dog is the powwow jingle bell dancer over here, who is getting restless. And
yes, he was.
So when we walk down the hall here, everybody says, you know, oh, jingle bells, Merry Christmas. No, he's a powwow dancer. That's why he rings. So anyway, part of the whole scene for me, going away to college and, you know, struggling to overcome what other people saw when they saw me, was just harking back to my heritage and understanding who I was and what I was doing there at college. I was not there to party and take drugs. I was there to get an education, because my mother never was able to finish her education until I was in high school, when she finally studied for her GED. And so we do our homework together. And when I was in college, I, of course, had to buy the print books so I could get my readers to read them. And she always wanted me to bring my books home so she could read them. And she taught us all to love books. In our household, you know, you've seen the Walton thing where everybody's, good night, Elizabeth, good night, John Boy, you know, all this other stuff going on. Well, in our household, everybody took a book to bed and had the light on, and then at a certain time, my mother would say, okay, lights out, go to sleep. Well, my big advantage was Braille books didn't need lights. And so I could read my book under the cover, and my brothers soon picked up on that, so they'd make me read to them after the lights were out. And so in many ways, my culture made me a stronger, braver person, because I represented my people to people that didn't know me and didn't know my family. And my mother saw education as the armor that was going to make it possible for me to succeed in the world. And that's why it was so important for me to do well in school and to go out into the world and make my way. My uncle calls us assimilated traditionalists, because we still follow many of our cultural norms. I still cannot. It's a terrible thing. I hate it when I hear a baby crying in a restaurant, and I know that they don't want a strange blind woman running up to them and say, oh, let me hold it. But that's the culture base I come from. And I have occasionally, when I've heard anger in a person's voice speaking to a child, said, could I hold her, please? You know, and then, you know, I pick her up, I hold her, I calm her. And then I hope that by demonstration, I teach that every child is precious. Every child is beautiful and wonderful. And our role is to help everyone find their place in the world and to walk proudly in it.
Good afternoon. There. I'm not that tall, but I'm taller than Deanna. There we go. I was interested in Cheryl's comments and the overall topic of expectations, because I never had an issue of rising above expectations. I had the issue of meeting expectations. In the Jewish culture, education is something that is taken for granted. It certainly at least was in by my parents. The expectation was that I was going to college, and I didn't have a whole lot of say in the matter. And it probably turned out well that I was blind, because if I'd been sighted, I wouldn't have gone to college. I probably would have run off and enlisted, and maybe gotten killed in Vietnam, but ultimately I wanted to travel the world. So education was important, and when I was born, I was my parents' 10th and last chance to have a child. My mother went through 7 or 8 miscarriages, and I had a brother who lived 6 weeks and another lived 2 days. So, you know, when Cheryl was talking about encephalitis and the fact that she came out of that ordeal just blind, well, I can relate to that. I was the last chance my parents had, and when they discovered that I was blind, oh, well, that's, it could have been a whole lot worse. So as I say, education was critical. And maybe I come by my advocacy honestly. I went to a regular elementary school. Well, let me go back. The other thing that kind of marked me as having an interesting childhood, I was an only child, of course, and my father died when I was 11. You know, I was expected to do the usual things, but I had a very typical overprotective Jewish mother. And so what I tell people is I grew up because of her and in spite of her. I've known other Jewish men similarly situated, and they have the backbone of a codfish. I never yielded to that kind of overprotectiveness. She really did try to shelter me. It took a long time for her to be comfortable with me crossing streets. It was interesting. The one thing I always was, I always had, were opinions about everything. And so I learned the word opinionated at an early age, and my response was, "What's wrong with that?" And I haven't changed. But to give an example of the kind of woman she was and how that impacted me, probably 20 years ago, there was a movie out called Mask. And Cher was the mother of a child with serious disabilities, serious, I guess, facial disfigurements. And there's the scene in there where she confronts the principal and basically tells the principal, "My child is," you know, whatever the situation was, I don't remember precisely, but the child was going to, her son was going to participate. In junior high school, I broke my foot 6 weeks before the semester ended, and I was having trouble, ironically, one with Spanish and two with algebra. And my mother attempted to arrange for a tutor, since I was not able to go to school. And the principal said to my mother, "Mrs. Pomerantz, your son is blind. He's not going to college anyway. What's the difference?" Uh-oh. Well, imagine Cher in that movie and double it, and you had my mom. And basically what it amounted to, and I don't know that there are too many folks here from Southern California, Pam might perhaps remember, there used to be he was one of the original muckraking journalists, a guy named Paul Coates.
I remember Paul Coates.
My mother said, and I think the principal's name was Mr. Dooley, she said, "Mr. Dooley, if my son doesn't get a tutor, for his for those two classes. I'm going to Paul Coates, and I'm going to tell him all about you. I got the tutor. Now, I'd like to say that, that I passed the two classes that semester, but I didn't. I did the next semester. So I always had a pretty high sense of my own worth, perhaps too high at some points. But the philosophy that I picked up from her, she said, Mitchell, she always called me Mitchell, which is why I don't use it now. But she said, Mitchell, you're blind. And it isn't enough for you to be as good as the folks with whom you're competing. You got to be better. And I was very fortunate. I got pretty good grades through high school. I was one of the two class valedictorians, although it wasn't based on grades. It was based on the speeches we wrote in our advanced placement English class, and mine was one of the top. And I was fortunate that I had my mother's two brothers who were doing pretty well financially. They had their own business, and they put me through the University of Southern California. So I'm a proud Trojan. I lived in a dorm. I had a roommate the first two semesters, two different roommates. One of them was a buddy from high school, and I think within 2 months we learned to hate each other. So after my first year, I had my own room, which was fine. It had some advantages. Let's just leave it at that. I majored in political science. I've always had an interest in politics. And the idea was, and it was more my mom's idea than mine, I was going to go to law school. Well, I applied. Let me go back. You know, I lived in the dorm 5 days a week. I came home on the weekends bringing my dirty laundry, of course, because, yeah, I was a guy. Yes, I brought it. We had laundry facilities in the dorm, but, you know. I went and got my own meals. I wasn't on a dorm plan. I got my own meals. It was pre-disabled student services days, so I had to get my own readers. I had to negotiate with my professors about tests. And I think that made me a far better person, and again, a far stronger advocate. Because, yeah, when I got to college, their expectations were far different than my mother's and my family's. But I guess I never let that bother me. I simply said, well, here's where I'm coming from, here's where things are, and this is what I expect. I got turned down from law school, actually, the first time, because my grades were only as good as the entering class, not better. And I got turned down the second time because USC had a policy. They were only taking one disabled student at a time, and there was a guy who had better grades than I did. So, you know, I ended up going into government instead and being an advocate and being a policy wonk for 34 years with the city of Los Angeles. But even then, it took me a year for the city to hire me because at that time you had to have a driver's license even to take a test, regardless of what the job was. I fought them for a year. They finally hired me, and I had a pretty successful career, although their expectations, I think, were lower than my own. I know that I probably lost out on some promotional opportunities, although I did promote. But I lost out on some opportunities that I was interested in because of the myths and the stereotypes that the sighted public has about blind people and blindness. But, you know,
the fact that I did retire after almost 34 years and have a pretty successful life now, I think I owe a lot of it to my mom. And it's ironic that we're having this conversation in Las Vegas. The first time the Nevada Council invited me to their convention, I think was probably 2003 or 4. I'm one of those odd ducks. I enjoy public speaking. My mother had never heard me speak. And what Nevada Council wanted me to talk about was the people that shaped my life. And so I was able to talk about my mom and about her influence with her present. And again, it's ironic because it was here in Las Vegas over at the Blind Center. I recall, and I'll wrap it up here, but a comment about how I got involved in the blindness movement and the disability rights movement because it ties in with culture. I was, in an attempt to get into law school the second time, doing a thesis during... I went back to get a master's degree in political science, and I did it in 1 year. I did it in two semesters rather than the three or four usually taken. I was doing a paper on law school entrance policies and, in those days, the handicapped. And I was at UCLA, ironically, interviewing the dean of admissions at UCLA Law School, and I was kind of awestruck by the guy anyway because he was a fellow by the name of Fred Slaughter. That name may or may not mean anything to most people, but he was the starting center on UCLA's first national championship basketball team. And we were talking about the civil rights movement. Fred was African American. And during our conversation, I had an epiphany, and I realized that what people with disabilities and blind people are dealing with is very similar to what African Americans have dealt with, including the lowered expectations, the disrespect, all of it. And it was from that conversation with Fred Slaughter that I got involved in first the generic disability movement and ultimately the organized blind movement. So, you know, I think my upbringing, my family, my absolute stubbornness have brought me to the point I am now, and I'm basically pretty content. And I'm pretty proud of my accomplishments. No, I didn't go to law school. No, I didn't go into my family business and make a lot of money. But I'm satisfied with where I am, and I owe a lot of it, most of it, to my culture and to my upbringing. Thanks.
Okay, let me find it.
Yeah,
I'm almost there.
Right here.
Oh, okay, so I go. Oh, okay, there we are.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't want to eat that. Okay, Peggy said I have 5 minutes, so I'm going to give you guys the edited version. I grew up sighted. I grew up in a very strong Christian holiness Pentecostal family in Los Angeles County. My grandmother was a missionary from the time she was probably 15, 16. She actually grew up in Boyle Heights, and her family owned a restaurant. She married my grandfather in 1926. They bought the first house in Watts before Watts was actually a city or incorporated into LA. She raised 9 kids in that house.
in the middle of Watts. She was a missionary. She finally converted my grandfather to do the same thing, which she said was a hard job to do because he preferred to drink. But he finally converted. My father was the last of the nine she had. So my brothers and sister and I were the last four of her grandkids. I am the oldest, and much to my sisters and brothers' discontent, they can't stand that. Because like Mitch, I am opinionated, and I was bossy. But I also was an introvert. I did not like people, and that hasn't changed much. And what I loved to do was read. And I remember at 4 years old, finding the night before Christmas, it was my Christmas gift, and my mother found me in the closet with a flashlight, and I was four. And so I started reading at four, and I loved it. I still do. I was the kid that did not look like anybody in my family. I am dark-skinned, very thick black hair. Thick. When I say thick, take a horse's tail and braid it up. That's how thick. It usually was straight, but curly. And I wore glasses from the time I was 4 years old. And when I say glasses, they look like bottles. And they were blue. Eek. And I got them in kindergarten. So I had wore glasses from the time I was in kindergarten. My mom always says, and she still does, you are a very strong woman, but you have to realize that not everybody is going to like you. And I always tell her, I don't care. I have always been very accepting of myself. My grandmother, basically Gladys, I was her favorite because I actually looked just like her mother-in-law. I was pregnant with my second child. I have three grown kids, 37, 36, and almost 34. Two daughters and a son, four grandkids. Too many kids. I was pregnant with my second daughter, and I always felt like I wasn't a part of the Fortier family. My maiden name is pronounced Fortier. People pronounce it Fortier, Frontier, but it is actually Fortier, and it is a Cajun French name. We actually have, the other half of the family is in the South, Louisiana, and they won't have anything to do with the black half. But that's okay. We don't want anything to do with them. So we do have a lot of blood running around that's a little bit different from everybody else's, but that's okay. I grew up in church. So my faith and my ability to get through stuff comes from my faith in God. People don't realize that I grew up in church. I don't tell a lot of people. Because they said, well, you're not supposed to act that way. But I've always been a very independent child. So when I lost my sight, I was 42 years old. I was in a very abusive marriage, the first marriage. He decided that he had to destroy the right eye, which he did. I lost the left eye. I lost my right eye in 1992, the left eye in 2000. To a eye drop that Kaiser gave me, but come to find out that I have a very rare optic disorder. My immune system does not like my optic nerves, and it attacks the nerves. So I was always a sickly child too. My grandfather taught me how to play poker and cheat. He taught me how to play solitaire and cheat because I couldn't do any. I was always sick. So they realized even now that it was my immune system. When I lost my sight, I had two choices. I could live or die. And since I'm a bossy, independent woman, I decided, okay, I'm going to take a year and cry and moan and blah, blah, blah. But after that year, it was time to get up and do what I needed to do. So I did what I needed to do. And I've always believed that we have a hand to play. And if we don't play that hand, then why are we living? Every last one of us in this room has dealt with different circumstances, but we have come above those circumstances one way or another. I remarried a white Jewish guy. And it's ironic that he and Mitch have been friends for 51 years, okay? He's funny. He's crazy. Okay. But I enjoy life to the fullest. one of the questions that my mom asked Ken when she first met him, and she loves the ground he walks on, let me put it that way. She said, how do you deal with the fact that Pam is very aggressive? And he told her, no, she's not aggressive. She knows what she wants in life, and she's very assertive. And one way or another, she's going to achieve her goals. So I've always lived by that. And my mom, to this day, I always tell people, I can't tell that child what to do. She's going to do what she wants to do. But in the end, she's going to love the people she's doing it with. I have... Because of the family I grew up in, missionary work has always been important to me. But since my family couldn't keep me in church, that wasn't going to happen, I decided to be a nurse. I worked in the nursing field for 26 years, loved it, enjoyed my patients, had fun with them. I loved working with the elderly. They were hilarious. Always had great stories. And it's ironic, history is one of my favorite topics. And I didn't go to college. I barely finished high school because I was bored to death. And when my mom found out that I was bored, they put me in classes that had to deal with reading, English, Spanish, those types of classes. My grades excelled. Numbers, math, Mitch, you guys can have them. But to me, every day that I'm walking this earth and breathing, I have played every hand I'm going to play. And we have to play it. I'm not going to roll over and play dead. So I am Pamela Denise Fortier, okay, Hill Metz. And that's who I am. And that's who I will be until the day, okay, people have to bury me upside down because nobody's throwing dirt in my face. But that's how I am. And I don't apologize for being Pamela Denise Fortier Hill Metz. I don't apologize for it. I tell people, if you like me, you like me. If you don't, you don't. So, Peggy, my 5 minutes up.
And I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that Pam, when I told her 5 minutes, I knew that she was the one person I could count on because we call her the time monster. Whenever we have to do a timing and give people a certain length of time to speak, Pam is a person who does the timing. And just imagine, she has no problem in saying, your time is up. So are there any questions or comments from the audience for any of the panelists, anything that you would like to share?
They were wonderful. Yeah. I really appreciated their honesty, their openness, transparency, all of that. That's just not easy to do.
And as you listen, what I realize is that while we have come from somewhat different backgrounds, we've all gone through all of the same things at some point in our lives. Whether we were blind from birth, lost our sight as children or as an adult, we've all gone through similar situations. And I would say that because we're here today, we come through it pretty darn well.
I have one more thing to say, Peggy.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Is it okay for me to talk?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say that the wonderful thing that I appreciated about this conference today is that you say we all have similar experiences. The thing that I think is important is that sharing with each other, we can also learn from each other.
Yes.
That's really meaningful because there are differences, and from those differences we can learn to know each other better. And we don't all know each other that well. Just because we're all blind doesn't mean we all know each other that well.
That's true.
This is a wonderful opportunity, and I thank you for bringing this these people together and this wonderful program.
Thank you, Teddy. And Pam, you wanted
to say,
yes.
When I was pregnant with my second child, my auntie said, Pam, come here. Well, they called me Pammy, but when I reached 18, they had to stop calling me Pam. She took me to a portrait of a woman that had been dead since 1926. And I looked at that portrait and realized, that's me. My hair, my skin, my body shape, everything was my great-grandmother.
Wow.
It was like she's, wow. I am reincarnated, and her name was Pamela Denise. Denise is a derivative of Dennis. My father thought he was having a boy, ha. So that's who I favor, and my grandmother told me my attitude and everything was my great-grandmother.
Okay, any other comments? Well, again, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you all for coming this afternoon. I hope you have enjoyed the program, and I look forward to seeing you around the week. But again, next year we'll do. Oh, one other thing. We are not having our midweek social this year, and I know I've been chastised by several people. You have to do that next year, so we probably will. But in the meanwhile, we are co-hosting the Voices from Around the World with the International Committee tomorrow evening. It is from 5:30 to 7 or 5:45 to 7 p.m., and I don't know the room number, but tickets are still available. So do come by and visit with us tomorrow. And thank you again for coming today.
Thank you. I'm Marlena Lieberg, and you've been listening to the Multicultural Affairs program for the 2014 ACB Convention. Stay tuned for more from the 53rd Annual Conference and Convention of the American Council of the Blind from Las Vegas, Nevada.